Now we're holding on Tesvov Omud Beis by the Mishnah. We've been talking off and on about the matters of Tam and Muad. So now the Mishnah is going to start talking about defining that. So the details about Tam and Muad. We're going to learn more in the coming Parakim. But first, again, our Perek is almost more like a general introduction to the whole concept of Nezikin. So therefore, it mentions the point. So the Mishnah says, Chamisha tamin v'chamisha mu'adin. There are five cases in which an animal is considered a tam, and therefore the first couple of times that it does the damage, you're paying only chatzi nezek, only half the value of the damage. And as we've learned before, also it's capped at the value of the animal. V'chamisha mu'adin, and then there are five cases which are mu'ad, where the animal regularly does these kinds of things, and therefore you're paying the whole nezek. So first of all, habehema animal edis, an animal is not muad, loy ligach, not to gore, which is the av of keren, and then the other four we're going to list are all the tullis of it that we learned at the beginning of the parak. Veloy ligoif, not to push another, and not to push another animal or a person with its body. All of that would be a tulda of keren, because it's not usual for an animal to do that. Veloy lishoich, or to bite. Obviously, we mean not biting as part of eating, we mean biting to injure. V'loy lirboitz, not to deliberately lie on things, which we'll see about the details of that in the Gemara. V'loy livoit, or to kick. So all of those things are considered unusual. All of those are told us of Keren, and therefore the first couple of times an animal does them, then it's not muad. The muad literally means warned, because we have the pasuk muad biv'olav v'lo yishmiranu. The owner has been warned that his animal is dangerous, and he's not guarding it. So an animal is not muad. An animal is not warned as far as that, meaning that the owner can't be expected to know to begin with that his animal is prone to do these things, because animals are not usually prone to act this way. Then continues the Mishnah. On the other hand, here are the Mu'adim. Hashein Mu'edes Lechelos Aroila. As far as Shein, as far as the animal's teeth, is Mu'ad to eat what's normal for it. We're going to learn more about that in the next parak. What we mean is, in other words, for example, if the animal eats regular food, the kind of regular food that it would usually eat, then that's considered shein, and then the person, the owner of the animal, is chayev nezek shalom to begin with. On the other hand, for example, if it eats clothing, that wouldn't be considered normal. That would be a tolda of keren. So we're going to those kinds of details we're going to talk about in the next parak. Second, haregel mu'edes lishba b'derech hilocha. The regel, the feet of the animal, are mu'ad as far as breaking things as the animal walks along. Again, that's something perfectly normal that the animal is prone to do. It's not necessarily looking where it's going. And for that reason, we've learned before that's potter in Rosh Hashanah. These two things, shein v'regel, because you have every right to take your animal down the street. And other people need to know that the animal is normally prone to eat things and prone to step on things, and therefore make sure that their food and their kalim are far away. The third one is v'shur amur. Then you have a case where shur has gored or pushed or bitten or whatever, all those things we said before, three or more times, where now it's mu'ad. The owner has been repeatedly warned by Edim in front of Beis Din to take care of his animal, and he hasn't, so now he's chayiv nezek shalim. The fourth one, v'shur hamazik v'shus hanizik. The fourth one is even when the animal is a tam, but it damages in the property of the nizik. And we've learned before the opinion of Reb Tarfon. The Gemara is going to mention it over here as well. That holds that in that case we don't distinguish between tam and muad because it was in v'shus hanizik. Reb Tarfon holds he always pays nezik shalim. And the fifth one, v'ha'adam. And the fifth one is a person who causes damage, whereas we're going to learn later on in the Masechta, Adam Muad La'olam, a person is always Muad, so even if he causes damage while he's asleep or whatever, then he's still Chayim. Where we learned at the beginning of the Perek, Tosfos had brought from a Yerushalmi, if let's say a person is sleeping, and while he's sleeping, somebody came and put Kalim near him, and then he broke them in his sleep, then he's Potter because he had no way of knowing even before he went to sleep that those were going to be there. But if he knew they were there before he went to sleep, then yes, if he damages them while he's sleeping, he flails around or whatever, he's going to be Chayib because Adamor Loilam. Rashi points out, now you have other Nizikin that are Muad as well. After all, you have Bur and you have Esh. But here we're focusing on things involving living creatures. So among living creatures, then you have these five. Continues the Mishnah now actually you have other ones as well. Why they're not included in the list before, we'll talk about later on. So the Mishnah continues, has a wolf, v'ha'ari, or a lion, Vahdoiv, a bear, Vahanomer, a leopard, Vahabardless, or Bardless. Now, the Gemara is going to discuss the Bardless at some length over here, and we're going to see different possibilities what it is. Elsewhere in Shas, Rashi defines a Bardless as a skunk or a polecat or some similar creature to that. In modern Hebrew, Bardless means a cheetah. Not necessarily doesn't mean that in the Gemara, but there was a similar word, paradolos, or something like that, which in Greek in that time meant an animal like a leopard or a panther or whatever. So conceivably over here it might mean that, although the Gemara is going to give a different definition of it. Anyway, v'hanochosh, and a snake. So all of those harel mu'odin, all of those are also moored in the sense that when they cause damage, then they never go through a tam stage. Unlike an ox or most other animals, domesticated animals, where normally they start out as tam, they're not normally expected to cause damage, at least unusual kinds of damage. And then eventually, if you're warned enough times, then they become moored. These animals are not in that category. They're always moored. Now Rashi learns that what it means is they're moored as far as everything. So no matter what, for example, the lion, let's say at the it goes. Well, we're going to talk about in the Gemara as far as the lion and the other animals eating. There we may have a distinction between tam and moored as far as them, but as far as the other kinds of things, let's say for example, we said that kicking is not normal. Kicking or biting is not normal for a sure. Therefore, there's tam versus moored. Whereas for a lion or any of the other ones, a wolf and all the other ones in this category, we would say, according to Rashi, it's not like that. We would always say that they're moored to begin with. On the other hand, Tosfos talks about that not necessarily. Say for example, a wolf goes and kills an animal, or a lion goes and kills an animal, or as we'll talk about in the Gemara, the details of how a lion eats versus other animals. Then that's normal, so that would be considered shein, and that's what the Mishnah means when it says that they're moored to begin with. But other kinds of things, Tosfos learns, when an animal acts in an unusual way, then we would even these wild animals, which are not really domesticated, only tamed, then we would still say Tosfos learns that you're paying only chatzi nezek the first few times. So according to Tosfos, when it says over here that these six creatures are mu'adin, according to Tosfos, we don't mean mu'ad as far as everything. We mean only mu'ad to cause injuries or damage in the normal way that they do. The difference being, of course, that a lion, for example, is much more prone to cause damage in its usual ways more than, let's say, an ox is. But anyway. Rabbi Lozer, I remember his man shehin b'nei tavus einin mu'adin. Rabbi Lozer says no. When these creatures are tamed, not domesticated, really, you can't domesticate these creatures. But when you tame them, when they're living with you as tame animals, then they're not mu'adin. Then when you raise them in their house, then in your house, Rabbi Lozer learns is saying that they're not moored to begin with. Only if they do damage a few times, then you have the usual rule: you're warned and based in, and then they become a moored. V'hanochash moored la'olam. Only a snake is moored always, even when it was raised by you in your house. An interesting point in this connection you have in Bilam's brachas to the Jewish people. He compares them a couple of times to a lion, and there's some place in a sicha where that ever talks about the deeper idea why that is, why the comparison to a lion based on what we're saying over here, according to the Chachamim, and this is the halacha, that a lion is never really completely domesticated in the sense, even though you may have raised it by you, and it may have been living by you for years, decades even, nevertheless, at any moment it could go wild and start causing damage, and we're saying it's more la'olam. In the same way, in the positive sense, you can have a yid who for many years has been living in a way where he doesn't even know anything about Yiddishkeit, and then all of a sudden something happens and his pintel yid is woken up, and all of a sudden he roars to life as a lion-like yid. We've seen lots of examples of that over the last month and a half, ever since the Simchas Torah attacks in Eretz Yisrael. So we really see that how lots of Yidden who until now seem to be like tamed, defanged lions, all of a sudden their Yiddishkeit is woken up and they realize who they really are. This week's parasha, actually, you have something about it in Medrash Rabbah on this week's parasha as well, that tells a couple of stories involving Misyavnim at the time of the story of Hanukkah that happened with. Okay. Anyway, the Gemara starts off. Mid katoni hashen mu'edes lechol. So we're saying among the mu'adin, we're saying that the teeth of an animal are moored to eat what's normal for it. So miklal debachatzara nizak askinan. Evidently, then we have to be talking about in the chotzer of the nizik, because again, where does shein apply? It doesn't apply if it's in the mazik's property. We've learned before the mazik has every right to say, "What is your animal doing on? What is your payrus or whatever doing on my property that that you should say I'm responsible for anything that happened." Then you have in Rishos Harabim, you're also potter for shein. You're only chayav for shein if the animal goes into somebody else's property and eats. V'katoni ein behema ein mu'edus l'shalom kule. Now the Mishnah had also said though that an animal is not mu'ed to gore or push or whatever as far as paying the whole thing. Av chatzi nezek m'shalemes, but the implication is you're paying chatzi nezek. Money, now who would that be like? Rabbanan. Apparently that's like the Rabbanan. De Amri, where they say, as we've learned before, Meshuna Keren Bachatzara Nizek, unusual Keren, Keren and all its toldos, which are all unusual for an animal to do, when it takes place in the property of the Nizek, Chatzi Nezek Huda Meshalim. They say, since the animal is a tam, you're paying only Chatzi Nezek, like you would any other place. Just like you would in Rishos Harabim. So they say it's the same in Chatzara Nizek. Ema Sefer, but then look at the end of the Mishnah, where it continues, Shur HaMuad, V'Shur HaMazik, V'Shus HaNizek, V'Adam, where the last three in the group of five Mu'adim, we said were Shur HaMuad, fine, that's easy enough to understand, and a Shur HaMazik, V'Shus HaNizek, so an animal that's a tam, and it's located in the Rishus of the Nizek, and it causes damage over there, V'Adam, and a person, and all of those were saying a Mu'ad, and you're paying Nezek Shalim, Asan, let him tire. That part of the Mishnah seems to go like Reb Tarfon. Do'amah Meshuna Keren Bachatzara Nizik Nezik Shalom Hodu Meshalim. He says that unusual Keren, when you're in the property of the Nizik, then you're paying Nezik Shalom. As we're going to learn in the next Perek, towards the end of the next Perek, why Reb Tarfon holds that way. Anyway, so the question is, Reishit Abonin V'Sefer Reb Tarfon. Are we going to have that the first part of our Mishnah is according to the Chachamim and the second part is according to Reb Tarfon? We don't usually have that. And the answer is, like we learned the other day, Ain, as a matter of fact, yes. As we find that Shmuel said just that to Rabbi Yehuda. Shinina, he told him sharp one or big toothed one or whatever, the various possibilities of what Shinina means. Shvoik masnisin, give up trying to reconcile the Mishnah according to one Tana. We learned this the other day in connection with a Braisa as well. So Shmuel had said the same thing as far as a Braisa over there. But Torah basroi, and follow what I'm saying. Reishit Abonin v'Sefer Reb Tarfon. Yeah, the beginning of our Mishnah is according to the Chachamim, and the end is according to Reb Tarfon. It's unusual to have to do that, but nonetheless, that's how it is, because there really isn't any other way of understanding the Mishnah. On the other hand, Rabbi Lozer, Mishmeid the Rab, Amar, Kuler Reb Tarfon. On the other hand, Rabbi Lozer says in the name of Rab, actually, you could explain the whole thing of Reb Tarfon. Because Reisha b'chotzer hamiyuchedes l'peiros la'echad mehen. Because in the Reisha, we're not talking about it's a regular chatzar hanizik. Now, so you're asking why in chatzar hanizik? Why would you be paying chatzi nezik for the animal's keren? So we're saying in chatzar hanizik, you're paying for shein and you're only paying chatzi nezik for keren. So we have to consider that we're not talking about it's only a chatzar hanizik. You're talking about reisha b'chotzer hamiyuchedes l'peiros la'echad mehen. The chotzer was reserved for peiros for one of them. Only one of them has the right to bring his peiros in there. V'lozev l'shvarim. As far as oxen, either one is allowed to bring it in there. So the nizik has the right to have his peiros in there. Both of them have the right to bring their oxen in there. So therefore, delegabe shein havila chatzar hanizik. So relative to shein, it's considered the chatzar hanizik. Therefore, you're paying nezik shalom because Reuven's animal went in there, where Reuven has every right to bring his animal in there. Fine. So therefore, even Reb Tarfon would agree we don't call that chatzar hanizik and make him pay nezik shalom if the animal gored in there, because after all, he has the right to bring his animal in there, and therefore, it's not totally chatzar hanizik. On the other hand, only Shimon has the right to have his peiros in there. Therefore, relative to peiros, we can consider it chatzar hanizik. Therefore, he's chayav for shein in there. V'lozev l'shvarim. And as far as for both of them have the right to bring their oxen in there. So therefore, so relative to Shane, it's considered the property of the Nizik, because only he can bring his payrus. As far as Keren, though, it's considered the equivalent of Yerusha Sarabim, because both of them have the right to bring their oxen in there. So even Reb Taifin is going to agree that in that case, if the animal gores over there, then you're paying only Chatzi Nezik. Now, Tosfos has, this is according to Rashi. Tosfos, the other day, when we learned about the, yesterday, about this whole matter of a chotzer, that 2 days ago, actually, we learned about a chotzer that one of them uses for payrus and the other one uses for shvarim on Daf Yud Daled. We went into a whole thing about that. So Tosfos had understood over there that Tosfos had a different girsa in the Gemara and understood that we were talking about that you had a case over there involving a chotzer where neither one has the right to bring oxen in there, because neither one is allowed to bring his ox in there, but payrus they're allowed to bring in there. So here Tosfos, in a similar vein, explains that we're talking about the same idea over here, that it's different than Rashi, who says that what it is only one is allowed to bring in his payrus. Neither one, Rashi learns both of them are allowed to bring in their shvarim. Tosfos is girsay, in keeping with how they said on Daf Yud Daled, is one of them is allowed to bring in payrus. Neither one has permission from the other one to bring in his oxen over there. Tosfos mentions that girsa and discusses it a little bit, but anyway, the point is, we can distinguish between whether the property is meant to bring in oxen, or whether the property is meant for both of them to bring in payrus or not. In this case, only one of them has the right to bring in payrus, therefore it's considered his reshus as far as payrus, but as far as goring, it's considered both of their reshus, according to Rashi, because both of them can bring their oxen in there, according to Tosfos, because neither one can bring their oxen in there, and therefore even Reb Taifin agrees that he's paying only Chatzi Nezek. So however, Omer Rav Kahana, Rav Kahana points out, Amrita L'Shmaita, the Shittim Kubetz is a little further along when the Gemara continues with other scenarios over here. The Shittim Kubetz points out that one person can bring in payrus but not other metaltlin, for example. So you're not going to have, let's say, we're going to talk about soon, a case where one of them is allowed to bring in payrus and all other metaltlin as well. Because that's a usual thing. We're not going to say he only has the right to bring in payrus, as opposed to say that they shouldn't be able to bring in their oxen, especially like Tosfos says, is a very common thing. After all, oxen are not very clean creatures, so they might well tell each other, don't bring your ox into the schatzer, because then it's going to get filthy. Okay. However, the Gemara says, Omer Rav Kahana, Amrita L'Shmaita Kamei D'Rav Zvid Min HaHodah. I set over this discussion to Rav Zvid Min HaHodah, where you have, again, Shmuel is saying there's no way to make the Mishnah work according to one Tana. Necessarily, it has to be part according to the Chachamim and part according to Reb Taifin, versus Rav is saying that you could make it all work according to Reb Taifin and assume that one of them has the right to bring in only payrus, and the other one, according to Rashi, both of them have the right to bring in their animals, and according to Tosfos, neither one does. And for Omali, and Reb Zvid says, Mi motzis mukmala kulak Reb Taifin, how could you think to say that the whole Mishnah goes like Reb Taifin, the way Rav wants to? Hakatani, the Mishnah continues, Hashen mu'edis lechalas aroywa, that as far as Shane, we're saying that the animal is moored to eat what's normal for it to eat, meaning, in other words, that it'll normally eat fruits or vegetables or other things like that, implying roi la ein Shane roi la loy. So only if it eats things that are normal for it, then you're paying nezek shalim. But if it eats things that are not normal for it, then apparently you're not, because that would be considered not normal to do. The E Reb Taifin Ha'amah Mashuna Keren Machatzara Nizik Nezik Shalim Mishalim. Doesn't Reb Taifin say that in the Chotzer of the Nizik you're always paying Nezik Shalim? So then, according to him, even if it ate something that's not normal for him to eat, then he's going to be paying Nezik Shalim, because after all, eating something not normal is a Tolda of Keren. And according to Reb Taifin, you're paying Nezik Shalim for Keren in Rishus HaNizik. So therefore, now again, here's where the Shittim HaKubetz points out, you're not going to say that he has right to only bring in Paris and nothing else. He's not another. You're going to say he doesn't have a right to bring in Kalim and then to bring in Kalim and clothes over there. Why would anybody make such a rule? So therefore, it's more logical to assume if he has the right to bring in Paris, he also has the right to bring in his utensils and his clothing and things like that. And still we're saying that if the animal eats those, apparently you're only paying chatzi nezek, but according to Rav Tavfin, you should be paying nezek shalim. So you still can't make the Mishnah work completely according to Rav Tavfin. Rather, we have to answer that no, the whole Mishnah has to go like the Chachamim. What about the fact that the end of the Mishnah seems to imply that if you're in the Rishus of the Nizik, you pay Nezik Sholim, even if the animal is a Tam? The Mishnah is missing a phrase. The Mishnah means to say like this: there are five cases where an animal is a Tam. Namely, the five things that it might do that it described in the Mishnah: goring, pushing, kicking, lying down on things, and kicking. So all those five, it's tam for to begin with. The im huadu, but here's where the Mishnah, here's the part that the Mishnah left out. The im huadu chamishtan mu'adim, if in any of those five cases the owner has been warned that his animal is doing these things, then it becomes mu'ad after three times. The Shane Varegal Mu'adin Mitchilasan. As far as Shane Varegal, though, those are moored to begin with. Those you don't need any warning because it's normal for the animal to do that. The Heichan Ha'adosan Bachatzana Nizak. Where do they become moored? When it takes place in the property of the Nizak. So, in other words, we thought until now that when the Mishnah said Chamisha Tamin Bachamisha Mu'adin, then it meant the Chamisha Tamin are the five things Keren and its Tordos, and then the Chamisha Mu'adin are the rest of the Mishnah where it continued Shane Regal, Ashur Hamu'ad, etc. Now we're saying that no, the Chamisha Mu'adin are not actually spelled out in the Mishnah. Rather, what we're saying is you have the Chamisha Tamin. Those five Tamin can all become Mu'adin if the animal gores a few times or kicks a few times or bites a few times, etc. Then, and it's when you warn and basting repeatedly, then the animal will become Mu'ad. Now, besides that, the Mishnah is going on to point out, then you have cases which are Mu'ad Mitchilasan, namely the rest of the ones that it says in the Mishnah, which that would be B'chatzar HaNizik. So then when the Mishnah mentions Ashur HaMazik v'Rishus HaNizik, it means that when it said Ashur HaMazik v'Rishus HaNizik, it meant when the animal causes damage, not with its horns, when it causes damage with its teeth by eating or with its feet by stepping on things is b'Rishus HaNizik. So the Mishnah is not at all implying that a tam ever pays nezek shalim, and that would be like the chachamim. So according to Reb Tavfin, yeah, he'd be paying nezek shalim if he's in rishus hanizek. That was what caused us this whole trouble. Now we're saying that you don't need to say that. The Mishnah is implying that no, the mu'adin mitchilosan, the ones that are mu'ad to begin with, those are paying nezek shalim b'rishus hanizek. Among them are where the animal causes damage, namely with its teeth or with its feet. Well, maskifla ravina. So in other words, what we're doing is we're taking the words shur hamazik and birshus hanizik and breaking them apart. What we're saying is, in effect, shur hamazik means an animal that causes damage, and the words birshus hanizik are referring back to the whole second half of the Mishnah, namely when we start talking about shane and regal. Where do those take place? Birshus hanizik, and that's where you chayim. The problem with that is maskifla ravina hakatani lakamon. But in the next perek we learn, the next perek is going to be now that we had our first perek that gives us the general rules. And as we learned before, we have several things in the Mishnayos in our perek where we said tana v'hodr mefarish. First, the Tana is telling us something briefly, and then in subsequent perekim he goes and tells us in more detail. So in the next perek, it uses the expression shur hamazik b'rishus hanizik keitzad. What does it mean? How does it work out that when the shur causes damage in the property of the nizik, then how is that? What are the rules about it? So, Iyamat Bishlema Ayriba. Now, if you're going to say that our Mishnah is referring to a case of Shur Hamazik Birshus HaNizik, if that's one sentence that goes together, Mishoma Hachikatoni Ketzad. Well, that explains why it uses the word Ketzad later on in the next Perek, because having mentioned that point in this Perek, now we have to see how we define it exactly. Eli Iyamat Loi Ayriba, but if our Mishnah never even mentioned that concept, if our Mishnah never mentioned the concept where the animal was a Tam and was in Birshus HaNizik, but rather we're saying shur hamazik means where the animal caused damage, and birshus hanizik does not refer to causing damage with its horns, but rather with its teeth or with its feet, then My Ketzad. Then what is the next parak when it starts talking about Keren Bishwas HaNizik? What do you mean Ketzad? Ketzad would imply we already mentioned this before, and now we're going to start giving you the details of it. But according to that way of looking at it, our Mishnah has not even mentioned that point yet. Ela, Amar Ravina, rather, Ravina says, it's true that Chasuri Mechsira, true, the Mishnah is missing words in order to make it work according to the Chachamim, but not the words that you wanted to say before, but rather B'Hachi Katani. You have to rather parse the Mishnah as follows. Again, starting like we said before, fine, Chamisha Tamim Haim, there are five cases of Tam. It is true if any of them become moored, then the five of them become, if any of them have been worn repeatedly, then the five of them become moored. It's true. That's the word. I agree, says Ravina, with what we said before, that that is the part that's missing from the Mishnah. But now we're going to continue a little differently. Shein and regal are moored to begin with, meaning again, even the first time that the animal eats something or steps on something that it wasn't supposed to, then when it's normal for it to do, then it's moored to begin with, and you're paying nezek sholim. Vizehu shur hamoored. That is the case of shur hamoored, where you chayev nezek sholim to begin with. Now, another possible case, v'shur hamazik v'shus hanizik, then you have the case where an ox causes damage in the v'shus hanizik, namely with its horns or with any of the other things that are told of Karen, pushing or biting or what have you. When it's in v'shus hanizik, you should know machloikas reb taufin rabbanim. That is subject to a machloikas of reb taufin and the chachamim, which the next perek is going to tell us how. So that explains the case out of the next perek. Our Mishnah is implying, without saying so in so many words, that there was machloikas of Reb Taufin and the Chachamim on that case of Shur HaMazik v'Shus HaNizik. And now the next parak is going to delineate out for us what exactly is the nature of that machloikas and what does each of them hold and why. Then the Mishnah continues, V'yesh mu'odin acherim kayyotze ba'elu. Then you have other animals that are moored that are similar to those where also, to begin with, they're moored, and it's not a matter of you have to be worn repeatedly. And they are the wild animals that we mentioned. So therefore, so in other words, the Mishnah is not telling us there are five tamin and listing them, and then five mu'odim and listing them. The Mishnah is telling us there are five tamin. Any of those five tamin can become a moored. Aside from that, there are several others that are mu'adin mitchilasan, and then there is yet others that are also mu'adin mitchilasan, namely the wild animals. Now, why would the wild animals be listed separately in that case? So one point is because they're much rarer. You don't have them. The Rambam points out you simply don't have them very often in society. People don't usually have them in their house, as opposed to people commonly have oxen and other domesticated animals by them. Therefore, the Mishnah would list them separately. Because up until now, we're talking about things which a person would normally have around, some of which are more mitchilosai, and then you have the more unusual ones where a person wouldn't even usually have them around in the first place. So the Gemara says, Tani Nami Hochi. In fact, we learn a Braisa exactly, which spells it out exactly the way Ravina understands our Mishnah to be missing the phrases and to be supplemented. A Braisa says exactly that. Chamisha Tamim Haim, there are five kinds of cases, five kinds of things that an animal might do for which to begin with its tam, a domesticated animal. Vim hua du chamishtan muadin. If the owner was worn repeatedly, then they all five can become muad. V'shein v'regel mu'odin mitchilasen. Shein and regel are muad to begin with, because the animal is always prone to eat or to step on things. V'zehu shur hamuad. So that is the definition of shur hamuad. As far as v'shur hamazik v'shus hanizik machlokas v'tav from Rabbanan, the case where the animal gores, which is an unusual thing to it, so for it, and it's still a tam, but where it does that v'shus hanizik is going to be a machlokas v'tav from the chachamim, whether you're paying nezik shalom or not. Then the Mishnah would continue. Then there are other cases which are also moored in a similar vein. The six wild animals mentioned in the Mishnah. Okay, so we have a Braisa exactly agreeing with how Ravina said it. In fact, you have others pointed out what we had so far is how did we reach Ravina's statement is because we were trying to figure out. Who our Mishnah is like. Is our Mishnah like the Reb Taufin, or is it like the Chachamim? And how could we say that it's a? And how could we say that any part of it is like Reb Taufin, as we said before? So therefore, that led Ravina into saying this Chasuri Mechsera. So now, Ika the Romi Lomirma. There are others who learned it as there are others who learned it that it started out with a contradiction. Tnan chamisha tamim v'chamisha mu'adim. First, the Mishnah says there are five tamim and five mu'adim, and the assumption is that all of them are listed in the Mishnah. Namely, you have the five tamim of goring and pushing, etc., and then you have the five mu'adim, shein, regal, shur hamu'ad, etc. And the question was, the way, according to this version, that the discussion started out is, the two leka, what do you mean? Are those the only ones? What about the six wild animals? Why are we saying only five mu'adin, when in fact we have, once we count those, then we have 11? And the answer came to that, that Ravina answers the Mishnah is missing words, and what it means to say is the remainder of the Mishnah, beginning with Shein and Regal, is not listing the Chamushim U'adin, but rather it's the Mishnah is implying Chamisha Tamim Haim. There are five cases where an animal is a Tam, the Imhuadu, Chamishtan Mu'adin, and if any of the five were warned, then they all become moored. The Shein Regal Mu'adin Mitchilasin, Vizero Shara Moored, Shein and Regal are moored to begin with, and that is the definition of Shara Moored, or those are the same as a Shara Moored, because you don't need the three times warning for Shein and Regal. As far as Vashara Mazik, Vishrusan Nizik, Machlokas, or Tyrefin Rabbanon, then if it causes damage with its horns or biting or whatever in Vishrusan Nizik, then Rab Tyrefin and the Chachamim disagree whether you're paying Nezik Sholim for that. The yesh mu'adin acherin kayetz ba'elu, and then on top of that, you have other kinds of animals that are more similar to them, namely hazeh v'hari hadov v'hanom v'habarlus v'hanochash. So we reach the same conclusion, but we came to it in a different way by pointing out the Mishnah itself seems to be inconsistent by first saying there are five tamin and five mu'adim, where it sounds like we've listed the list of all the mu'adim, and then it turns out that we have a lot more. And the answer is that no, the Mishnah is not listing the mu'adim at all. The Mishnah is implying that the five tamin can become mu'adim, plus you have various other cases where an animal can be mu'ad to begin with, namely Shein Veregel and the six wild animals. Okay. By the way, we have in many places in Kabbalah and in Chassidus, we have the concept of five gvuras. So maybe that ties in with why the Mishnah Dafka wanted to phrase it as you have five cases of Nizakin, of Tam, and five of Mu'an. Because after all, Nizakin is an expression of gvura. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, one of the things that an animal doesn't normally do, v'loy lirbots, an animal doesn't usually lie down on things in order to break them. So the Gemara says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, l'shono ala pachin gdolim. Now that would only apply if the animal laid down on top of big jugs or big kalim. It's not normal for it to do that. So therefore, that would be a tolda of keter. Pachin ktanim or chayhu, but if it's on small kalim, it's normal enough for an animal to do that. Therefore, Rabbi Elazar is saying that would be a tolda of regel. So as usual, in Rosh Hashanah, so unlike now, if it's a tolda of keren, then we're saying he'd be chayiv for it in Rosh Hashanah, but only chatzi nezek the first few times. Afterwards, it's nezek shalim. If we say that it's a tolda of regel, then we'd say he's potter in Rosh Hashanah. But if it's in Rosh Hashanah nezek, then he's paying nezek shalim to begin with. So if it's small ones, he says it's normal for an animal to do that. So the Gemara says, "Lema Masayale." Can we say that Rabbi Elazar is supported by what the Mishnah says? The Mishnah says later on, or Bryce actually says, "Habehema mu'edus lahalach kedauko l'shaber." An animal is moored as far as it's already prone to walking normally and break kalim as it's walking. It's also normal for the animal to squash people or animals or kalim. Now, what do you mean? Our Mishnah had said that it's not normal for an animal to lie on kalim and break them. So wouldn't that show that, yeah, you have to make the distinction between big ones and small ones? Big ones, it's not normal for it to lay on top of. And if it does, then that would be our Mishnah saying is an example of keren. And on the other hand, small ones, it's normal for it to, and that's what the Braisa means when it says that an animal is moored to squash kalim. The Gemara says that's not a proof because Dilma min hatzad. Maybe the Braisa means as far as squashing them from the side. In other words, you may have the animal is walking near a wall and there are kalim standing over there and the animal brushes by them and squashes them and breaks them as it's walking by. Maybe, though, as far as laying on them is different, maybe an animal is not moored to lie on top of any kind of kalim, even small ones. Okay, that's version number one. Ikadamri, another version is Amar Rabbi Elazar, Loi Tema Pachin Doilem Hu Delav Orche. Don't think that when it's large kelim, then it's not normal for it. But you would argue that when it's small kelim, it is in small jugs, it is normal for it. Ella, in the second version, Rabbi Elazar is saying, even small jugs, it's not normal for it to lie on. So according to him, no matter what kind of jugs it lay on, it laid down on, it would still be treated as keren rather than as regal. So therefore, again, but only chatzin nezek. Whereas if it had been regal, you would be potter you'd be potter in Rosh Hasharabim. But in Rosh Hashayachid, you'd be paying in Rosh Hashanizik, you'd be paying nezek shalim. So the Gemara says, Maisvi, in that case, I have a contradiction according to the second version. The Braisa had said, that it's normal for an animal to squash animals or people or kalim. To squash people or animals or kalim. And the answer is, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Domam and Atzad, Rabbi Elazar would answer no, the Braisa means where it squashes them as it's walking by with the side of its body, not the same thing as when it's not the same thing as when it's lying down. And a third version, Ikad Rami Lamirma. There are others who reach this conclusion by pointing out a contradiction between the Mishnah and the Braisa. Tnan v'loy lirbut. The Mishnah had said that the animal is not moored to lie on kalim and squash them. But we learn in a Braisa that it is moored to squash animals or people or kalim. There's a difference between large ones and small ones. So both according to the first and the third version, there is that difference between large and small one. Only in the second version did we say there's no difference, and either way he's chayiv. The poskim paskin like the first and like the third version, which is therefore, so there is a difference between large and small ones. Small ones, it's normal for it to lie on. Large ones, it's not. Therefore, small ones would be a tolda of regal, and large ones would be a tolda of keren, with each one with the different respective dinim. Where you draw the line between small ones and large ones, I don't know. It may depend on the size of the animal, or it may depend on other considerations. Okay. Then we said in the Mishnah, has evahari v'chola. We mentioned six kinds of wild animals. And we said that all of them are mu'adin mitchilasan. Again, according to Rashi, they're mu'ad for everything that they do. According to Tosfos, only for the kind of things that it's usual for them to do. So it's true that these animals are going to be more usual to cause damage than an ox. But nevertheless, within each one, there's a normal way in which it behaves. And therefore you would be chayev nezek shalom for that. But something that's unusual even for this kind of animal, the Gemara is going to talk soon, for example, about lions. The Gemara is going to establish soon that lions normally eat their prey alive. They don't wait for it to die first and then eat it. So therefore, if a lion were to do that, that would be something unusual. And according to Tosfos's way of looking at it, then that would be chatzi nezek because it's unusual even for a lion to do that. Okay. So one of the ones on the list in the Mishnah was bardless. So my bardless, what is the definition of bardless? The other ones we all know. We know what a zev is. We know what an ari is and so forth. The only one the Gemara wasn't sure about what it means is bardless. So my bardless, Amar Rabbi Yehuda nafraza. It's a creature that's called in Aramaic nafraza. My nafraza, well, apparently in a later generation, they weren't familiar with that name either. Amar Rabbi Yosef apa. So Rabbi Yosef says it's also known as apa. So the Gemara says, Maisvi. We have a contradiction, though. Rab Meir Oima Afa Tzavoya. Rab Meir says that also a Tzavoya is an animal that's moored mitchilosoi. Rab Elazar Oima Afa Nachash. Rab Elazar says also a snake. V'om Rab Yosef Tzavoya Zer Apa. And Rab Yosef says Rab Meir's Tzavoya is the same as Apa. So therefore, so Rab Meir is adding something that wasn't in the Mishnah. Therefore, how can the bardless of our Mishnah be an Apa if Rab Yosef defines a Tzavoya as an Apa? Gilyan Ashas points out over here based on a Tosfos in Sanhedrin, Marshall mentions it over here also, that the Apa is also identical with the Ether, which is known to be a very dangerous kind of snake. It's sometimes translated as a viper. So in any case, but Rameyer, in any case, is trying to add something to our Mishnah. So fine, you can say maybe that the Apa is not the same as the Nachash. Fine, because you could say a Nachash is a regular snake, and an Apa or Efe is a type of particularly very venomous snake. So fine, but the point is, if you're saying that the Bardalus is the Apa, and then Reb Meir is saying that is adding the Tzavoya, and Reb Yosef is saying Tzavoya is an Apa, so what's going on over here? So the answer is, Loikasha, kan with Tzavoya Zocher, kan with Tzavoya Nekeva. There's a difference between a male and a female Tzavoya. So Rashi gives two explanations. Rashi's first explanation is, the one in our Mishnah is a male Tzavoya. What is a Tzavoya, by the way? In modern Hebrew, a Tzavoya is a hyena. Whether it means that in the Gemara over here, again, since Rabbi Yosef is defining it as an apa, which again, we're saying maybe the same as Giri Nashas and other Mephoshim are saying is the same as an Efa, a viper, then that would mean that that would be what a Tzavoya is that type of snake. Anyway, Rashi's first explanation is the one in our Mishnah is a male Tzavoya, and Rabbi Yosef is saying that it's also known as apa. Now, Rabbi Meir is also adding the female Tzavoya. So that one does not also have the name. It does not also have the name Apa. Now, the reason why the male is called Apa is because, as the Gemara is going to go on to point out now, it transforms over time into various other creatures, and eventually it becomes some kind of dangerous creatures. And so Rashi explains that would be why it had so many names. Why did we start by saying it's called Bardalus and it's called Nafraza and it's called Apa? Because it keeps on transforming over time into other creatures. So that would all be the male. Meanwhile, a male is adding, you should know that also the female Tzavoya is also considered a dangerous animal and is more than Mitchilasa. That's Rashi's first explanation. Rashi's second explanation, which he prefers, which he learned from his Rebbeim, is the other way around. The Mishnah is talking about a female Tzavoya. The Reb Meir is adding the male Tzavoya, and the point is, why would you have to add that? Why would you think the female is any different than the male? Since the male transforms into various other creatures, as the Gemara is now going to go on to say, then therefore you wouldn't know that's included in the category of our Mishnah, and therefore the Meir needs to add it. So the Gemara says, D'tanya, as we learn in a Braisa, Tzavoya Zocher L'achas Sheva Shanim Nasa Ataleif. A male Tzavoya, after 7 years, turns into an Ataleif, which is a type of bat. Ataleif, l'achas sheva shanim, nasa arpod. After 7 years, that creature transforms into an arpod, which is another type of bat. Arpod, l'achas zayin shanim, nasa kimosh. After 7 years, that turns into a kimosh, which is a type of thorn, which is a type of thorn. We have a mention here and there in Tanakh. There's the word kimosh, kimosh v'choyach, and other words like that. And there's nevuos about enemies of the Jewish people, that their lands are going to be desolate, and kimosh, which are thorn bushes, are going to grow in there. So that's what it means over here. Kimosh l'achas sheva shanim nasa choyach. After 7 years, the kimosh becomes a choyach, which is another kind of prickly thorny plant. Choyach l'achach sheva shanim nasa shed, and after 7 more years, that in turn transforms into a shed. So Marsha brings over here in this connection that, first of all, now there is a gemara in Bechoris that says that an efer, which again we said over here, the apa of our gemara is identical with the efer, is a very dangerous kind of creature where it takes 70 years for it to even bear children. So in that case, how would that fit with what we're saying over here, that after 7 years it transforms into something else? So Marashah says that the efer of the posuk may be referring to a type of snake, whereas the efer of our gemara, the efer or apa over here of the gemara, may be something different. The point being, though, in other words, that Marashah says, the point is, any creature produces offspring that are like it. So therefore, the efer, being the worst of all snakes, the most dangerous kind, therefore it ends up becoming the most repulsive kind of flying creatures, namely various kinds of bats, and then the most repulsive kinds of trees, namely thorn bushes. And eventually it becomes a shed that causes damage. So that's the significance of what the Gemara is saying over here, is, in other words, that each of these creatures as something dangerous and hazardous in the world, and it keeps on transforming into another and another kind of hazard, because they start out like as evil creatures, and not really, I mean, evil in the sense, I mean, Hashem created them with this nature, but still, in other words, they represent powers of Tumah, basically, and therefore they keep on transforming into ones that are more and more that are more and more hazardous, until ultimately it turns into a shed, which is a semi spiritual creature that causes damage. So that's the significance of what we're saying over here, says Marsha. Ben Yehoyada explains that maybe what it means is, in other words, not while the animal is alive. It means after the animal dies, then eventually the dust of the animal transforms into a worm that's shaped like a bat, and the same thing with each of the other one. It doesn't mean literally that it transforms while it's alive. It just means that, in other words, from the dust of it comes there are produced these new kinds of creatures. Continues the Gemara. Here's another one. Shedu shel adam la'acha shevashanim nasa nachash. A person's spine after 7 years turns into a snake. V'hani mili de lekara b'modim. However, that would only apply only if he does not bow down by modim in Shemana Esrei. What's the connection between a snake and modim? Tosfos points out when you bend by modim, you actually, and not just by modim, by all the times you're bowing in Shemana Esrei, you're supposed to bend down and then you straighten up like a snake, meaning gradually. You don't bend up, you don't unbend right away, because you don't want to show like bending was a burden to you. So you rise up gradually the way that a snake does. So now, when the person doesn't do that, then midah kenegan midah, then he ends up turning into a snake. Tosfos also brings a second explanation that the reason is, because what it means is, in other words, like this, a person by tchias ameisim is going to be brought back to life using the luz bone, which is in his spine, and therefore this person who didn't bow by modim doesn't deserve tchias ameisim, and therefore the whole thing transforms into a snake. Tosfos wonders, in that case, why should that be so? I mean, why is not bowing by modim, why is that serious enough to make the person lose his chelek l'olam haba? So Maharal Shah mentions over here the point, there is the point that, after all, when you're bowing to Hashem, you're showing a humility in front of Hashem, and therefore you have to act opposite your nature. So when you don't do that, when a person doesn't show that bittul to Hashem, then therefore he's acting like the original nachash, after all, by Gan Eden, was walking upright, and then he was made to crawl on his belly. So therefore, this person, being that he remains upright and doesn't bow before Hashem as he should, then therefore he ends up turning into a snake. As far as what Tosfos says, that therefore, because of that, he might lose his place in Olam Haba and in Tchias HaMeisim, there's many places in Chassidus, starting with in Lakuta Torah, where it talks about the reason is because, after all, that shows that he lacks that sense of bittul at all to Hashem. And since Tchias HaMeisim in particular comes from Keser, which is beyond any level of lakus that we can perceive, so this person lacks that bittul to that level of lakus. Therefore, he's not going to be able to join in Tchias HaMeisim because he hasn't shown that degree of bittul. There's many places where it talks about that idea that kind of bittul is a necessary prerequisite for a person to participate in Tchias HaMeisim. Many places in Chassidus where it talks about that point. All right, anyway, the point is, again, all Gemara is saying there is a difference between a male and a female tzavoya, according to Rashi, according to the two possibilities in Rashi, which one is which? As far as that, therefore, that the Mishnah had to mention one, and Rameyer now is adding the other one. Or actually, according to Rashi's first explanation, Rabbi Yosef's definition that Savoya is Appa is not referring to the mayor's statement, it's rather something else. So the Savoya, or Mishnah, was a male one, and Rabbi Yosef calls it also Appa, and Rabbi Meir is saying that also a female Savoya, which is not called Appa, is also included in that category. And again, according to Rashi's second explanation, the other way around, the Mishnah was referring to the female one, and Rabbi Meir is adding also the male one, both of which, according to that, are called Appa. Okay. Omar, we said in the Braisa, that Rameyer adds that also its Savoya is one of those animals that is moored mitchilasa, and that's originally dangerous to begin with, and therefore there's no tamen moored in it. And Braisa had said, Rabbi Lazar had said, also a snake. The question, what do you mean, also a snake? V'hanan t'nan, didn't we say in our Mishnah, Rabbi Lazar Omer, Bizman Shane Bnei Taurus, all the six wild animals that we mentioned in our Mishnah, five of them, when they were raised by people, when they were tamed, Einam Mu'adim, then they're not Mu'ad unless they become Mu'ad eventually. V'hanochash Mu'ad La'olam, only a snake is always Mu'ad. Whereas when in the Brice, so according to Rabbi Lazar in the Mishnah, five out of the six animals we mentioned are not Mu'ad Mitchilasim, the only one that is the snake. So how in the Brice is Rabbi Lazar saying, Af Hanochash, also the snake, implying that he agrees with her mayor that there's another one that's also considered Mu'ad Mitchilasim. And the answer is, you're right, Tony Nochosh, you're right, you have to learn in the Mishnah, not that he says Af Hanochosh, but he says Nochosh. So the mayor is saying, and that Savoya is also included. And Ramey and Rabbi Lazar are saying, no, the Savoya is not included, but the Nachash is. Okay. Continues the Gemara. Omer Shmuel, Ariba Shusarabim. When a lion, if a lion eats an animal, eats a sheep or whatever in Rosh Hashanah. So it depends how it ate it. Doras V'ochal, if he clawed the animal, but didn't actually kill it, and then he ate it while it's still alive, then you're potter because that's considered shame. That's the normal way of the animal eating, of the lion eating, and you're potter in Rosh Hashanah for shame. Torah for achal, but if he killed the animal and then ate it, chayev, then you would be chayev because that would be part of peret. Exactly that. Doras va'achal potter, kiven de urchel midras, because it's normal for a lion to do that, to claw the animal and eat it without waiting for it to die. The Rosh makes a point. Since the lion is the king of animals, therefore it has no fear of other animals, therefore it will eat its prey even while it's alive. It doesn't even have to wait for it to be dead, because not afraid of it, it will go and eat it right away, as opposed to the other predators that we mentioned in the Mishnah. Those are more fearful, so they're going to wait until their prey is dead before they actually eat it, so it doesn't attack them or whatever. So a lion, it's normal for it to claw the animal, and elsewhere in Chulin, by the way, the Gemara mentions that when a predator like that attacks a prey animal, it sinks its claws into it, and that causes a certain kind of poison to get into the victim, which then kills it. What exactly the nature of that poison is, we're not really sure, although there is a suggestion in Sfarim that deal with such things, that it's talking about basically bacteria from under the creature's claws that then get into the wound and infect the victim and kill it. Whatever the case, the point is, when the lion does that, the victim while it's alive, then that's considered shame. But when he doesn't, when it waits for it to be dead, then that's not normal for an animal. So therefore, it's a doras for ochel potter. So if the lion claws the animal and eats it while it's alive, then you potter in your shosarabim, kiven to urche the midras, because that's the normal thing for a lion to do. Have a like commercial ochel potter for yirakas. So it's the equivalent of an animal eating fruit or vegetables in your shosarabim. Have a like shame your shosarabim. So that's the equivalent of shame in your shosarabim or potter. And we know that you're potter for shame your shosarabim, because the pasuk says uvir, as we've learned before, uvir b'sde acher, that the animal grazes in somebody else's field. So the Rosh actually talks about the point. You know, when you think about it, there are two reasons why you would say that you're potter for Shein Veregel, Rosh Hashanah. One of them is just Gzeres HaKosev, that it says it's only when it's on the property of the Nizek. And the other one is also because of Svara, because after all, it's normal for an animal to go in Rosh Hashanah. So now, when it comes to the lion, really you only have Gzeres HaKosev. It's not normal to take an animal through, it's not normal to take a lion through Rosh Hashanah. So if you looked at it only from the point of view of the second reason, then you would say you are in fact chayev either way. Only if we say it's Gzeres HaKosev, only then would you say you're potter for your lion eating and for your lion going and clawing an animal and eating it alive in Rosh Hashanah. But then we continue. Taraf lav urchihu, but for it to wait until the animal is dead is not normal for it. Therefore, that would be keren, and therefore for that you'd be chayev in Rosh Hashanah. Well, the Gemara says, you're telling me it's not normal for a lion to wait until its prey is dead before it eats it. V'haksiv, we have a pasuk from Nahum, one of the Tirei Aser, that seems to say differently. The context of the pasuk, the whole nevuah of Nahum, the whole thing is, Nahum is one of the Tirei Aser. His whole nevuah, it's only three prakim, is a nevuah against the city of Nineveh and the kingdom of Ashur in general. So previously we had, in a previous generation, Hashem had sent Yonah to Nineveh to get them to do tshuva, and of course, famously they did. But afterwards, they relapsed and they went back to acting corruptly and so forth. So now the Eibishter sent the Navi Nahum to say a nevuah against them of how they're going to be completely destroyed, and everybody can take a lesson from them to not ever behave that way. So Nahum describes over there. He gives a metaphor of a lion to describe how Ashur preyed on all the other nations while they were at the peak of their power. The whole pasuk, so I was going to quote the pasuk phrase by phrase and ask from it that about this point that we're saying that a lion eats its prey while it's alive. So the pasuk says, "Aryeh tordef b'dei gerosav." The lion is tordef for its cubs. So b'dei meaning for the amount that its cubs are going to eat. So we see that a lion is tordef, which implies that it waits till the prey is dead. And the answer is yes, shvil gerosav. For its cubs, for its lion cubs, it'll wait till the prey is dead. It's not going to give it to them while it's alive. But for himself, the lion will eat while its prey is alive. So the Gemara continues. What about the pasuk continues? Mechanic luluv oisav. He strangles animals for his lionesses. And the answer is the same thing. Shvil levoisav, for his lionesses, he'll do that. But for himself, he'll eat it while it's alive. What about by malit teref chodov? The pasuk continues. He fills up his holes in his den or whatever, with teref, again, from the same word as trefa. And the answer is, again, b'shvil chodov, for when he's storing it in his holes, then he makes sure it's dead first, because that's going to be storing it for later on. And the same thing when he finishes off, the pasuk finishes off, u'ma'onosav trefa, he fills up his dens with trefa, same thing, b'shvil ma'onosav, when he's doing it in order to store away in his den for later on, then he'll make sure it's dead first. So this pasuk is talking about how the lion is feeding his cubs or his lionesses or storing up for later, but not when the animal is eating on the spot. When the lion eats on the spot, then it eats it while it's alive as well. So no contradiction from that pasuk. Okay, the Gemara says, "V'hatanya." What about? Fine, we don't have a proof from the pasuk, but what about we learn in a brisa? V'chein chayish shenichnas al-chatzan al-nizek. We're going to learn this brisa in full in the next perek, but the brisa first talks about other cases of unusual damage, and the brisa says the same way: if a wild animal goes into the chotzer of the nizek, perfor behem of ochla baser, if it killed an animal over there, a sheep or whatever, and ate the meat of it, mishalem nezek shalem, the owner is paying nezek shalem, meaning because that would be shein, and of course shein you are chayev in the other person's property. Now, presumably, when it says v'chein chaya, it means all the wild animals. Tosfos points out if it mentioned a specific animal, fine, you could say that, but when it says chaya generically, then presumably it includes the lion as well. And Tosfos also says you can't say that this is going according to the Tarifin, as we've learned before, because the context of the Braisa is clear that we're talking about Shein, not about Keren. So we see that it is normal for any wild animal, including a lion, to kill the animal before it eats it. So the Gemara answers no, because you can be talking, the Braisa will be talking about where the lion killed the animal because it's going to save it for later. And again, we just brought from the pasuk that the lion will do that. Well, the Gemara says, what do you mean? What do you mean? The Braisa says that it ate it. And the answer is b'shenim l'chava. We can be talking about where the lion originally planned to save it for later and then decided to eat it now. I said, but no, you didn't. Well, how are we supposed to know? Do we have a way of knowing what the animal, what the lion was thinking? And besides that, with Shmuel's case also, what are you telling me that if the lion kills and eats in Rosh Hashanah, then you're saying it's Keren because it's not normal for it to kill first? You could say the same thing. Maybe it planned to leave it for later, and then therefore it would be Shane, and then it changed its mind and ate right away, and therefore you should be Potter. You can't be Machayev, the owner of the lion in Suffolk, after all. So that doesn't work. So Omer of Nachum Yitzchok, so rather of Nachum Yitzchok says, no, the Braisa is talking about Letzdodin Katoni. The Braisa is going to the sides, meaning the Braisa is talking about two different cases. You have one case shetofalaniach. You have with an animal, and yes, we're including wild animals. When we say wild animals, yes, we are including lions as well. What we mean is either shetofalaniach, where it killed the animal, planning to save it for later, oi dos of ochla, or if it killed, or if it clawed the animal and did not kill it and ate it right on the spot. In those cases, meshalamas nezek sholim. In both of those cases, it's paying nezek sholim because that's shein, and those are normal things for a lion to do. So no contradiction to what Shmuel is saying, because in fact the braisa is not talking about one case. The braisa is talking about two separate cases, where it clawed the animal and then ate it while it's alive, and the other one where it killed it but then is taking it to save for later.
With all these cases in a lion,
yeah,
a lion should be mechuyev in a rishus rabin because it's a danger animal. So you have to make sure, even rishus rabin, that you should be extra careful because a lion is a lion.
So that is what we mentioned before. That's what the Rosh had mentioned before. That it depends. If you say that the fact that you're potter for shein in rishus rabin is because gzeiras hakosiv, well, gzeiras hakosiv is gzeiras hakosiv. There's no arguing with that. If you say it's because it's normal to take your animal walking down rishus rabin, it's true. It's not normal to take your lion walking down rishus rabin. Tosfos actually discusses over here that there may be a difference between whether the animal is whether the lion is in a cage or chained up or something versus where it's not. You do have a Mishnah in Sanhedrin where Rabbi Lozer says, or Tosfos says, it may actually be Rabbi Lozer says that you're allowed to kill them on the spot because even though they have an owner, you tell the guy you have no right to keep a dangerous animal around like that. So Tosfos discusses over there that there may be a difference whether the animal is in a cage or not, still it's able to reach out and grab something versus where you're just letting it roam free in the streets where, yeah, then anybody can kill it. So there is that consideration. So now, actually, I mean, when Mephoshim point out over here, a number of Mephoshim point out over here, this that Reb Nachman Yitzchok is giving the answer with Tzedodin is really only needed as far as the lion. As far as the other animals, fakir, as far as a wolf or the other animals, you don't need that Tzedodin because the fact is a wolf does wait until its prey is dead before it eats it. So therefore, you can say very simply by those, the Braisa is talking about exactly that, Torfa Behemoth Achla, that it killed an animal and ate it, then you pay Nezek Shalim because for a wolf or a leopard or any of the other ones mentioned in our Mishnah, then yes, that's the normal thing for it to do, to wait till the prey is dead. Only when it comes to a lion do we have to say Tzedodin Katani. Okay, Ravina Omar. Ravina gives a different answer. Kika Omar Shmuel Ba'ari Tarbus. The difference is Shmuel is talking about a lion that's been tamed. It was raised by a person in his house. So therefore, it's less likely for it to cause damage. Therefore, Shmuel's statement would follow the opinion of Rabbi Lazar in our Mishnah that when the lion has been tamed, then it's not normal for it to do that kind of damage. So as opposed to the Braisa, we'll be talking about a lion that was captured from the wild or whatever, and therefore, sure, it's normal for it to, then therefore, if it does go into somebody's chotzer, then you pay Nezek Shalom regardless, because then it is normal for it to cause damage like that. So the Gemara asks, "Afilu dorsa nami l'chayev." Well, in that case, then you should be chayev in that case, even if it clawed the animal and ate it in Rishus Rabim, because you're saying that if you're talking about that the animal was tamed, if you're talking about the lion was tamed, then it's not normal for it to do either kind of injuring or killing an animal, not to injure it and eat it alive, and not to kill it and then take it away for later. So no, Ela de Ravina lav de Shmuel Itmar Ela Masnisa. Rather, Ravina's statement was not said in order to answer Shmuel, because in fact it's true, it doesn't work to answer Shmuel's statement. You want to say that Ravina, so you want to make Ravina's statement still work, you're going to have to make it work directly on the Braisa. Meaning that Ravina is saying, Kitoni masnisa ba'ari tarbus, that the Braisa, when the not Shmuel's statement about distinguishing what the lion does in Rosh Hashanah, but rather the Braisa, which talked about the lion going into the chotzer of the nizek and talking about and killing an animal and then killing an animal and eating it, then it pays Nezek Shalim. So Ravina is saying And if the Braisa is talking about Ba'ari Tarbus, it's talking about a tame lion, Ba'aliba the Rabbi Lazar, Dam Lava Urche, and that would follow Rabbi Lazar, who says that it's not normal for it to do. So the question is, so in that case, then why are you paying Nezek Sholem? Then it's only Chatzin Nezek, because after all, it's not normal. And the answer is D'Yayin. Okay, well, it's talking about where you were wounded, and now the animal is becoming moored. The question is, my hide, Katoni, like I was told to shame. Then in that case, why is the Braisa mentioning it in the context of tulis of shame? Because the earlier part of the Braisa, which we'll learn in the next parak, is talking about various cases where an animal eats something that's normal for it, which is shame. So now, why is this Braisa continuing with this? If Ravina is saying that the Braisa is going according to Rabbi Lazar and it's not normal for it, then it should be considered Karen. It should have said it in a context of talking about tulis of Karen. The Gemara says Kasha. You're right. That would be a Kasha on Ravina. As usual, kashe is not tiyuvda. It's not an absolute refutation. We could answer that even a tame lion, it may not be normal for it to cause damage, but nevertheless, maybe when it does, then you could say that after all, it is a carnivore, it is going to eat meat, and therefore, when it sees an animal, especially if it's hungry or whatever, it is likely to eat it. So fine, Rebbe Lazar is going to say in our Mishnah that it's still considered tam, that maybe it's considered tam originally, but maybe once it does it, then already it then maybe you chayiv nezek shalom right away. Okay, fine. The Mishnah says, "Ma ben tam lemuad." What is the difference between tam and muad? Elasha tam mashalim chatzin nezek migufay. The difference is that a tam, you're paying only chatzin nezek, and you're paying only migufay out of the actual body of the animal that caused the hezek. Meaning, as we've learned before, that the amount you're paying is capped at the value of the animal that caused the damage. So, if you have the amount of chatzin nezek that you should have to pay is 200, and the animal is worth only 100, then you're just giving the other guy the animal as a whole, or selling the animal and giving them the whole 100. You're not required to take another $100 out of your pocket and pay as well. Umur mishalim nezek shalim min ha'aliyah, as opposed to when the animal is more, then you pay nezek shalim and you're paying min ha'aliyah. Literally, min ha'aliyah means from your attic, but the Gemara is going to explain that min ha'aliyah means from the best of your property, meitav, as we've learned earlier in our parak. So the Gemara says, my aliyah. What does this word aliyah mean? Amar b'lazer, b'ma'ulash b'nechasev, means he's paying out of the best of his nechasim, like we learned earlier, that if he's paying in land, he has to pay with idis, otherwise known as meitav, the best quality land that he has. And if he's paying with metaltlin, then we ended up saying, according to the Papa and Rav Huna Brei Rav Yeshua, and according to most poskim, halacha is like them, you can pay with any metaltlin, because any metaltlin are considered meitav, because you can easily take them someplace else and convert them to cash. So that's the word aliyah in our Mishnah, refers to that. So Omer Abel, as a V'chein Hu Omer, as we have an example with word Aliyah, or similar word, B'male, means the best quality. The Pasuk says, B'abach Chizkiyahu, V'yishkav Chizkiyahu Yavoy, so Chizkiyahu lay with his fathers, meaning he passed away, V'yikberuhu B'male Kivre B'nei David, they buried him in the male of the Kvarim, of the family of David. And what does B'male mean? V'omer Abel Lazar, B'ma'ula, B'mayla means Eitzel Ma'ulim Shavim Mishpacha, means they buried him near the top, near the most distinguished members of the family, Maninu David Ushlim. They buried him, namely, in the plot of land where they buried all the kings of Yehuda, or most of the kings of Yehuda. They buried Chizkiyahu in the most distinguished place next to David and Shlim. Why Dafka? Why did he get that? Why did he get that source? Marsha points out that after all, first of all, in Chizkiyahu's times, actually, there was a Jewish leader by the name of Shevna. He's mentioned in various psukim in Yeshaya and in Malachim, where the Gemara in Sanhedrin explains that he was actually trying to usurp Chizkiyahu's position as king. He was trying to make peace with Sancheiriv and with the Ashurim, and then depose Chizkiyahu and become king instead as a vassal of Ashur. He even, the psukim mentioned in Yeshaya, went and made himself a grave in that area, in that plot of land where the kings were supposed to be buried, figuring that one day he'll be king and he'll be buried there. And Yeshaya says to him a sharp nevuah about that. So now, when Chizkiyahu passed away, So they put him, they upgraded him to, they didn't want to use that grave that, that Shevna, the Rosha, had made for himself. So instead, they put him in the best possible place near David and Shlomo. Another point is also that that after all, that David and Shlomo built the Beis Hamikdash, and Chizkiyahu prevented it from being destroyed because Sancheiriv in his times would have destroyed it. But Chizkiyahu got everybody to learn Torah, and that's as we learn in Gemara Sanhedrin, he got everybody to learn Torah at a very high level, and therefore that he saved the Beis Hamikdash from being destroyed. So therefore, he deserved to be buried near David and Shlomo in recognition of that. Anyway, so we see the word b'male doesn't mean at the heights of, it means at the best quality of. So the same way, aliyah in our Mishnah means the best quality of property that he has. So the Gemara says, in a similar vein, we have about one of the earlier kings of Yehuda, about since we're talking about how Chizkiyahu was buried, so now the Gemara digresses a second to talk about another one of the kings of Yehuda, where it also says something unusual about how he was buried. The pasuk says about King Asa. Also was the third king of Malchus Yehuda after the kingdoms were split. So you had, there was David and Shlomo, then the kingdoms were split. And then you had, in Yehuda, you had Rechavam Aviyah Asa. Asa was the third one. He was a tzaddik, and the pasuk says about him, Vayikberuhu b'kivroisim ashokor lo b'ir David. They buried him in the grave that he had dug for himself in the city of David. Vayashkivuhu b'mishkav ashamile b'samim uznim. They lay him down in the resting place that he had filled with spices and znim. So my besomim was znim. What does that expression mean? Rabbi Lozo omer zini zini. Rabbi Lozo means, Rabbi Lozo says that it means they had many different types of spices over there. The Aramaic word for min is zan. You have, for example, in Targum Unkelos, on the word laminehu in Parashas Bereishis, Rashi points out, laminehu was translated with znoi. So the same way over here, znim would mean different types of spices. Rabbi Shmuel Nachmani Omer B'samim Shekolam Ariach Ben Boli De Zima means spices that had such a delicious fragrance that anybody who would smell them would have thoughts of zima, thoughts of znus, because they were such good quality spices. What's the point of that? Marsha points out the psukim mention that that Asa for a couple of years before he passed away, he was very sick. He had some kind of foot disease. The Gemara in Sota tells us that it's a disease called podagra in Greek. In English, it's called gout. So he had a disease in his feet, and he prepared this grave while he was still alive, and therefore he needed various kinds of spices in there. Apparently, Marsha seems to learn, in other words, that otherwise the smell from how the disease attacked his feet would have been too strong, and therefore the spices were meant to counteract that. Now, the Maharal points out that you have the machlokes, this really is about what we call kamos versus echos. According to Rabbi Lazar, you had a kamos, you had in quantity, you had many different types, and according to Shmuel ben Nachmani, the greatness of it was in the quality, that the besamim were of such high quality. Okay. Since we mentioned a machlokes of Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shmuel ben Nachmani regarding the understanding of a pasuk, so now the Gemara digresses further to mention another pasuk where they also argued on the meaning of it. You have Yirmiyahu throughout Yirmiyahu's whole career as a Navi, he was persecuted a lot. Right at the beginning, Hashem tells him, "Don't you worry, nobody's going to be able to ever get rid of you because I'm going to be on your side protecting you." But we find over and over there were people who beat up Yirmiyahu, they threw him in jail. They plotted against him to inform on him to the king and get him in trouble or even to poison him. So at a couple of places in Sefer Yirmiyah, he's complaining to Hashem and asking that Hashem should stick up for him and punish these people. So in one place, he uses the expression, "Kichbaru shucha l'lachdeni." They've dug a pit to trap me. Ufachim tom l'raglai, and they've hidden pachim, which is another type of trap, by my feet. So what's this expression, "Kichbaru shucha l'lachdeni"? So Marsha points out, now it is true, the Gemara is going to point out in a minute, that at one point we find in Sefer Yirmiyah where they threw him into a pit full of mud, but the difference is there they expected him to die in there. They expected him to sink into the mud and die. The pasuk over here, Loloch Deni, suggests that they're not actually necessarily trying to kill him, just to trap him. So what does that mean? So Rabbi Lazar Amashachashru Mizoyna. Rav Elazar says it means they were suspecting him of being involved with a zoyna. And after all, Marashah points out, Yumi being a kohen, he's also to marry a zoyna. Rav Shmuel Nachmani says, worst of all, they suspected him of having relations with an Eishes Ish. Now, on one level, that can mean exactly that, that they literally suspected him of such things. And after all, Marsha points out, we find similarities between Moshe and Yirmiyahu. We find, though the Medrash said there were a lot of similarities between them. Both of them were Nevi'im for the Jewish people for 40 years, and there's a lot of other similarities between them. So therefore, Marsha points out, a similarity between them may have been that we know that Moshe had to separate from his wife, Yirmiyahu also. Actually, there is a place in Sefer Yirmiyah where Hashem tells him, don't get married and have children in this place in Eretz Yisrael, because everybody's going to go into Golos and your wife and children may not survive. So in other words, the same way as by Moshe, he separated from his wife, and that gave room for certain people to claim, look, how is it possible for a man to remain celibate, to remain alone for so long? He must be Mazana with somebody. The same way they use the same excuses against Yirmiyahu. On the other hand, the Maharal talks about, he says, on a deeper level, what it means is a zoyna and an eishes ish, respectively. A zoyna, being that she's in common with many other men, would imply that they're claiming that his nevuahs are not exclusive to him, that like he's just like a hanger-on to other people's nevuah. And eishes ish would imply that they're saying that his nevuahs are not even his at all, that he's just like plagiarizing from other people or trying to reach levels of nevuah that he has nothing to do with. Anyway, so the Gemara says, "Bishleim alaman de Omer shechashdu mizoyna." According to Rav Elazar, who says they suspected him of being involved with a zoyna, then we can understand that's why he calls it in the pasuk shucha a pit, because that goes with the pasuk in Mishlei, "Ki shucha amuka zoyna." A zoyna is like a deep pit, meaning Shleimer's warning: don't get involved with a zoyna. It's like a pit where once you fall into it, you're not going to get out of there so easily. So therefore, so Yumio would be using the same metaphor. But if you say that they're suspecting him of being involved in the Eishes Ish, why is he using the word shucha on that? Rav says, what's the problem? After all, to be involved with an Eishes Ish is a form of zoyna. After all, the definition of zoyna is a woman who's having relations with men she's not supposed to. So an Eishes Ish is off limits to everybody else except her husband. So yes, she is in the category of zoyna. Okay. The Gemara says, now, the other way around, according to Rav Shmuel ben Nachmani, that they're claiming that he's being involved with an Eishes Ish, then that explains, Yumio continues with the same tefillah in the next pasuk after we quoted. He says, "Va'ata Hashem, yadaita es kol atzosim olai lamavas. Hashem, you know all their plots against me for death." Because, yeah, if he's involved with an Eishes Ish, he's going to be chayav misa. But if we're saying they're only suspecting him of being involved with a zoyna, then what does he mean for death? Maximum he would get for that is malchus, not death. And the answer is, there he's referring to the fact that they threw him into the pit, into the muddy pit, and they expected that he was going to drown there. So in other words, according to that, there would be two different things. That number one, they're suspecting him of being with a zoyna, and number two, that they're partially trying to kill him by, for example, throwing him into that pit full of mud. Whereas according to the other opinion, we're saying that they were suspecting of being with an Eishes Ish, and that itself they could bring false aid him and claim that he did that and have him sentenced to death. So the Gemara continues. Now you have in the continuation of that pasuk, after Yirmiyah says that Hashem, you know all their plots against me. And by the way, you have later on in the Masechta, we're going to learn, it's not such a good idea to be Moser Dinei L'Shamayim. When a person is having difficulties with other people, and instead of going to Beis Din, he says, Hashem, you punish them, that's not a good thing. Hashem may actually end up punishing him first. We're going to learn later on in the Masechta. However, the Gemara says that's only when he has recourse by Beis Din here on earth. When he doesn't, then he is entitled to do that. Here, Yirmiyahu didn't have. There's nobody who's sticking up for him here on earth. Therefore, he had no choice but to complain to Hashem and ask Hashem to punish them. So that's fine. Anyway, so Dorash Rava, so Rava Daushin is the continuation of the pasuk we just quoted. We said, "Ba'ata Hashem yadaita es kol atzosim olai lamavas." Later on, the end of that pasuk has the expression, "V'yiu mochsholim lefanecha." Yirmiyahu says, "May they be made to stumble before you." Be'es apcha asei b'hem, at the time of your anger, act against them. So what does that mean? Omer Yirmiyahu lefnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam, afilu b'shar she'osin tzedakah. Even when these people, and particularly we're referring to the people of Anosis, which was actually Yirmiyahu's native city, But the people over there, particularly, were against him, as we find in a few places in the Pesukim over there. Even when those people try to give tzedakah, hachshilim, and the word lefanecha refers to tzedakah, Tosfos points out, as you have the expression, v'halach lefanecha tzedkecha, so even when they're trying to do tzedakah, hachshilim b'vnei adam, she'enim uhuganim, make them stumble over, let them trip over, and end up giving tzedakah to unworthy people, k'dei sh'lo yekablo alein schar, so that way they don't receive schar for the mitzvah, because after all, if they gave tzedakah to people who deserve it, then they're getting a schar for that. But now, the way they're acting, they shouldn't be doing that. And Marshall also adds, the fact is, we know that tzedakah has the power of turning away Hashem's anger. So now, Yirmiyahu is davening that even with, so at a time when you're angry, and they want to give tzedakah to take away that anger, it should be done. You should end up making it that the ones they end up giving it to are people who don't deserve to get tzedakah. That way, they don't get the schar for it. There is a Chassidic vort on that, though, that says that, these people are treating Yirmiyahu very badly, but still, what happened to Avos Yisrael? So there's actually an interesting Chassidic explanation. Yirmiyahu is saying, Fakir, if they give to people who are unworthy, fine, they may not be getting the mitzvah of tzedakah, but after all, the Eibishter treats people middah k'neged middah. Therefore, you should give them your chesed, even though they themselves are unworthy of it as well. So in other words, just the opposite. If they give tzedakah only to the worthy, then that would evoke by Hashem. Fine, if they're worthy of Hashem's chesed, then they should get it. Like this, they should end up getting Hashem's chesed, even if they themselves are unworthy. It is worth pointing out, by the way, to conclude this point, that when... even though, again, not only in this place, there are other places in Sefer Yirmiyahu where also he's complaining about the people of Anosos and asking that Hashem should bring horrible punishments on them. In the end, though, when the Jewish people came back to build the second Beis Hamikdash, and it lists the various families and the various places where people came from, it lists the people of Anosos. So what happened? Didn't Yirmiyahu daven that all of them should be destroyed and that Hashem should not have any rachmanis on them? The answer is they ended up doing tshuva. And Shuvah has the power even to overturn the harshest Xeris, and therefore, sure enough, they had descendants who came back to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash and resettle Eretz Yisrael.